Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. I'm Lisa, and tonight I'm really pleased to introduce Dan Hampton, who will be talking about The Hunter Killers, the extraordinary story of the first Wild Weasels, the band of maverick aviators who flew the most dangerous missions of the Vietnam War. Dan Hampton is retired now, but he's the author of Viper Pilot and Lords of the Sky, and then a fiction piece called The Mercenary. I want to give him the time to talk tonight, so please welcome Dan Hampton.
Well, thank you all for showing up tonight. I'm certain most of you had something better to do on a Wednesday night in Denver, but thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be back and to be at the Tattered Cover. Okay, The Hunter Killers. Pretend that that stack of books is Hanoi, okay? On July 24th, 1965, four F-4 Phantoms were about 35, 40 miles to the west of Hanoi. North would be that way. And they are capping or orbiting, waiting for MiGs to show up, enemy fighters. If they do, then they'll go kill them. Unfortunately, nobody came up to fight, and it was an overcast below and an undercast below and an overcast above, and they're right in the middle between two cloud decks. And as they're getting ready to go home, they're in a big turn back towards the south, back towards Thailand, to go hit a tanker to refuel and go home. And up out of the clouds came a flying telephone pole. No kidding. It was about that size. 25 feet long or so, going 3 to 4 times the speed of sound, with a 400-pound warhead on the end of it. And it was guided by a radar on the ground that had locked on to the Phantoms and launched the missile. Not just one, but actually 9. They weren't going to take any chances. This was before the days when I got into wild weaseling. They had no warning, nothing to tell them that anything was coming unless they saw it with their eyes and they weren't expecting it. And this thing came up out of the clouds and smacked into the the closest Phantom to Hanoi. It was called Leopard 2. That was the call sign of the day. Leopard 2 immediately went out of control. The guy in the front seat, as he's spinning out of control with the firelights and smoke in the cockpit and flames and everything else, tries to look in the back, and all he saw was the guy in the back kind of hunched over and blood coming out of his mask. As the plane went into the clouds, he ejected. Turns out the guy in the back seat died almost instantly. His name was Ross Faubert, and he was going home that very afternoon. He was giving a checkout ride to the guy in the front seat, guy named Pops Cairn, who had ironically and kind of sadly gotten shot down on one of his first missions in World War II and spent 18 months in Stalag Luft 17. So not the luckiest guy in the world, because he'd spend the next 7 or so years in various POW camps in North Vietnam. Well, the government, being the government, finally awoke to the fact that they had to do something about this. Doesn't really surprise any of us that have ever been with the government, right? The fact that they'd be a day late and a few dollars short. They'd known about this threat for some years. It was the same airplane that had shot, or the same missile that had shot down Rudy Anderson over Cuba a few years earlier, and Francis Gary Powers over the Soviet Union even before that. But it was considered a threat to bombers, to spy planes, not to fighter jets, because fighter jets obviously go very fast and maneuver very hard and well, but they overlooked the fact that the fighter jets at the time didn't have any warning system. Little disconnect there. And they hadn't done anything about it. Consequently, Leopard 2 got shot down. The government said, what do we do? They pulled a bunch of antennas and electronic equipment out of the only airplanes at the time that were really carrying these types of warning system, which was a B-52 bomber. The CIA wouldn't part with anything out of the U-2s, so they had to take these things out of bombers. And then they had to figure out a way to mount these antennas and warning systems into a fighter jet. Nobody had ever done it before. And to give the government credit, within 3 months or so, they had already picked the airplane and figured out how to make the mechanical parts work to the point where they could get some pilots and some electronic warfare officers into this airplane to try to go figure out how to kill these missile sites. For the government, that's lightning speed. Okay, by August of 1965, Alan Lamb, who is a personal friend of mine and is still very much alive and kicking, was the first pilot showing up down at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida to more or less pioneer this. He wasn't in charge of it at the time, but he was the first pilot that was picked because the general in charge knew that, like most fighter pilots, present company accepted, of course, he had a screw loose. Never mind, I'll get to that later. So Alan Lamb went down to Florida, not knowing what the mission was, not knowing where he was going, and not really caring. He was in a bad marriage, and that probably contributed to the fact that he'd rather go to Southeast Asia than stay in South Carolina and fight with his soon-to-be ex-wife. Anyway, when he got down there, he came face-to-face with something he'd never seen before. Because what you needed to go along with the equipment that they were putting in this airplane was a guy called an electronic warfare officer. By the time I got into weaseling, 25 years later, it was all combined to the point where one guy, the pilot, could do it all. But in those days, it wasn't. And there were no electronic warfare officers in the fighter community because who needed them? They were all single-seat fighters, and they dropped bombs and shot down other airplanes. This electronic warfare stuff was brand new. So on top of finding crazy fighter pilots to volunteer for this, which wasn't really a problem, they had to find electronic warfare officers coming out of bombers, you know, who fly basically like airliners, nice, high, slow, you know, not slow, but straight and level for the most part, and with a crew. And they had to find guys used to that environment that were willing to come sit in the back of a tiny little fighter jet and get shot at. It amazes me to this day that they actually found 8 guys initially to go do that. And in fact, when the mission was explained to them, a gentleman named Jack Donovan, who just passed away this year, said, I'm going to paraphrase the exact quotes in the book, but I'm going to paraphrase him. He said, you want me to ride around in the back of a teeny little fighter with a fighter pilot who thinks he's God and get shot at? You got to be essing me. I won't spell it out because there are youngsters here. But the YGBSM part of that became the Wild Weasel motto and was worn all through the rest of the war. And in fact, I wore it in both Gulf Wars, and weasels still wear it today. And of course, we've expanded it to apply to any number of governmental situations, and it applies very well, as most of you can figure. But the point is, these guys, by October-ish, had figured out how to work with each other, which by in of itself is a big deal, figured out enough about the airplane then to take themselves off out of Florida and fly west towards the Pacific and across the Pacific to Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. And then 2 days later, they took off out of Hickam and they flew to Southeast Asia and landed in Thailand. They didn't really know what to expect, but they were well prepared. All the empty avionics bays in the front of the F-100 was filled up with scotch and rum. They were ready for the worst, and they figured whatever came at them, they'd handle. And that's kind of the way they went into wild weaseling, because the whole idea of a wild weasel, unlike most airplanes who don't want to get shot at, these guys fly into an area and they try to provoke a fight, pick a fight with a surface-to-air missile site or sites and anti-aircraft guns, and they get shot at. And when they get shot at, the bad guys reveal where they are, and then if the weasel survives, then the weasel goes in and kills them. It's that middle part, that if they survive, that's kind of tricky. And when Alan and the first group landed in Thailand on Thanksgiving Day in 1965, they almost immediately went to work. 3 weeks later, they lost the first weasel, an F-100 flown by John Pitchford with Bob Trier in the backseat. Both guys, they got hit by an SA-2. Both guys ejected. Bob Trier had been an Air Force pistol champion and had always said he'd never survive life in captivity, so he elected to fight it out. And he took, by all accounts, maybe a half a dozen with him, but they got him in the end. Pitchford, the pilot, broke his knees, and shoulders, or his knees or his shoulders, nobody's quite sure, but he was all busted up and couldn't fight, so they captured him. And he would spend the next 7 years as a POW, getting all sorts of general medical treatment, as you can imagine. Alan Lamb took off with Jack Donovan 3 days later. And just before Christmas in 1965, they found a surface air missile site, probably the one that got Pitchford, on the shores of the on the banks of the Black River. If you all know anything about Vietnam, again, if that's Hanoi, the Red River kind of flows this way and north, and the Black River bends off and goes to the south. And the SAM site was just south of where the two rivers come apart. Pretty cleverly camouflaged, well hidden, and the weasels had to do what they did, and they flew along through the valleys and along the mountains, popped up to let the SAM look at them, disappeared back down because radars can't see through terrain, through mountains, popped back up, let them look at them until they got close enough for the SAM and the guns to shoot. And when they did, Alan, who's in an F-100, rolls in, and he's got rocket pods under both wings and a full load of 20-millimeter cannon, and he's got four F-105 thuds, D-model thuds, bomb droppers with him. So they're all strung out behind him, and he says, "I'm going to mark the target for you." Well, they thought he was just going to fire a smoke rocket. Now, Alan Lamb is quite a man. Even today, he can still hold his own with just about anything. And his idea was always to kill Sams, not to mark them. And so he rolled right in, and he emptied one of his rocket pods at the missile site. Managed to hit an oxidizer tank, I think, or maybe a fuel tank. Anyway, something blew up, and the four F-105s now see the target, and they all take turns rolling in and just plastered the thing. Well, as they're getting ready to leave, Alan notices that something down there is still shooting, probably a piece of AAA anti-aircraft artillery. So he rolls in again, and he launches all the rest of his rockets and then hoses off the full load of 20-millimeter cannon at whatever's left down there. And something else blows up, and the radar goes off the air. And that was the first kill of an SA-2 Fansong radar and the missile site. And more important, it proved the concept that wild weaseling would, in fact, work. This is where the Air Force and the Navy always kind of diverge. The Navy's idea was to go in and just force the radars and the missiles and guns to go down while guys were in the target area doing what they were doing. And then they'd all leave. The Air Force always figured, well, that's fine, but that means we still have the same threat to contend with tomorrow or next week. We're just going to go kill them instead whenever we can. Hence the wild weasels. And we still do it that way today. There's nothing wrong with that, but I've always been of the opinion, having been a weasel myself, that it leaves you with another fight to fight. And so the Navy was real big on that right along the coast, but most of the Air Force targets, like that first one along the Black River, was very far inland. And so they would always then fly with subsequent strike packages to go in and kill these sites instead of just suppressing them. So Alan got finished with that. He spent another few months in Thailand. He got two more missile sites to his credit. And they'd always known from the beginning of this program that the F-100 was never a permanent solution. It was too slow. It was a good airplane, but it was good for close air support, you know, in support of guys on the ground dropping bombs. But the main bomb dropper for the Air Force anyway in Vietnam was the F-105. And the F-105 was designed to fly low-level nuclear strike routes into the Soviet Union. And that thing, for those of you who haven't seen it, is a big old, huge, burly, manly, leaking, smoking engine with a little cockpit on the end of it. And it can loaf along at 600 knots and not even try. And the F-100, God love it, could barely make 450-ish. So there was always a big speed disparity. Plus, the F-105 was so much bigger for all the improvements that were coming in avionics and equipment. There was more room to install it and play with it and put it in. And so the next group of weasels that showed up early in 1966 were all F-105 pilots. They'd had to scrape together enough two-seat F-105s because single-seat fighter guys all hate two-seat airplanes. So the only two-seat F-105s they had were for training, and they had to get them all in from all over the world and patch them up and put them back together and make it work. And so when they came back over to Southeast Asia in 1966, and from then on until the almost the very end of the war, Weasels all flew F-105 F and G models. And that's kind of where the bulk of the book takes place. As this progresses and the threat gets worse and worse, the improvements come in and get modified. Guys go out, try it. Some live, some die. Overall, the Weasels had over a 50% attrition rate. So any of you that have ever been in a military unit know that a 50% attrition rate means you're either doing something really stupid or really dangerous. And in their case, they weren't doing anything stupid. It was just a very, very dangerous job, as it continues to be today. So as I trace the history of the Weasels, I wanted to do it like I've done with other nonfiction books, through the eyes of the guys that did it. To me, that's a better way to read history and maybe learn a little bit rather than just recite facts and, you know, dates and things. So I had the benefit of talking to guys that have become real heroes to me, like Ed Rock, a gentleman who started flying in Korea, flew two tours in Vietnam. Leo Thorsness, you guys ever heard of him? Medal of Honor winner. He was a Wild Weasel, got shot down in 1967 and spent 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, basically. These guys all reviewed, and more, these guys all reviewed what I wrote about them and made sure that it passed the logic test and the truth test before I turned the manuscript in. So you're not reading my words and my version of it. It's their story. And I think it was time for this. You know, I was alive during Vietnam, but I wasn't potty trained, right, Dad? Yeah. And I was never taught about the Vietnam War, like most people who came afterwards. And I've always been interested, when I write these books, in the history. Why were we there? Why were we fighting in World War I or Korea? Why were we even in Vietnam? So what I did in this book is I would put an action chapter in to keep you all awake, and then I'd talk a little bit of history, and then another action chapter, so as your chin hits your chest, you jerk back up and are awake again. Now, I didn't like that, but I wanted to at least to try to explain, because the Vietnam War is obviously a very complicated subject, why we had gotten into it and why we stayed into it and why the war was being fought the way that it was. And again, through the eyes mostly of the people that were there at the time doing this. So I learned an awful lot. I learned most of what hadn't been taught to me. I've had many, many people who were there who seem to appreciate the fact that some of this is getting aired out in the open. And the big point with this book, other than the story of the Weasels, was to get it across once and for all, and I think the country as a whole has figured this out, but to get it across again, that the people who fought the war had very little to do with the people that sent them over there. And I've had, a couple weeks ago in New York, I had a guy come up to me after I think it was Fox or CNN thing that I did, and he apologized to me. And he was probably, I don't know, in his mid to late 60s, and I said, I just met you. I couldn't have offended you. What are you apologizing for? And he said he'd been an anti-war protester in the 60s. And he said that while he still believed that the war was wrong, they went about it in the wrong way, and they should never have protested anybody who had anything to do with that. And I have never come across anybody in any of the books that I've written that has not recanted along those very same lines. So if there's any good that came out of it, I think that maybe the nation's finally healed to some degree, and there's been enough years passed between then and now that people are now very curious about this, and they want to know why. And I've been surprised by the veterans that I've talked to that are now willing to talk about it. And that's the only reason this book was possible, because they were willing to talk to me. I think some of that's because I was a Weasel myself. I flew in both Gulf Wars. And so they knew I just wasn't some, you know, boneheaded historian writer. And I could sort of appreciate what they had done. And then some of it, I think, as I said, is the time. You know, they feel like the time is right and they want this story told. So I hope you'll read it. I hope you'll enjoy it. If you do read it and you do enjoy it, I would ask for Amazon reviews. If you've got time, I donate to St. Jude's and Make-A-Wish, so it's for a good cause. If you don't like it, don't say anything. They do make good doorstops, so you could use it for that, and it still serves a purpose. And with that, I will again thank you all for coming, and I will be happy to entertain questions about this book or any of the other books, anything else that y'all want to talk about. Yes, ma'am.
In this book, do you have a favorite story that someone told you?
Oh, boy. A favorite story. You know, I do, actually, and it has nothing to do with flying, really. It's in one of the historical chapters. And this is, real quick, this is the background on it. Robert Strange McNamara, what a perfect name for that idiot, had decided that he wasn't committing to the war, he didn't believe in the war, he was going to try to solve our tactical problem with technology. And for those of you who have been in the military, you know that's a recurring American theme. In this case, it was very French. It was almost like the Maginot Line. He was going to put this string of sensors and all sorts of wacky stuff across the very narrow panhandle area of Vietnam. And the idea was people coming south down the Ho Chi Minh Trail would set these sensors off. He had sensors that would detect urine. Now, how they differed American urine from Vietnamese urine, who knows? They even had one that detected body odor. Yeah, exactly. You're like, huh? What? All sorts of seismic sensors. And the Vietnamese, you know, when they figured out what these were, they figured out how to defeat them. They'd parade cattle up and down the trail, or they'd pee on the sensor and then go the other way. Or they would simply go to where the line stopped and go a little bit further the other way, deeper into Laos, and go around it, kind of like the Germans did with that whole Maginot Line thing. Anyway, to combat that, McNamara and his whiz kids say, well, you know what? We can fix this. We'll make the muddy trail in the rainy season even muddier. We can make mud muddier. So they spent $500 million on Calgon and some other detergents that were then dropped by airplane through this triple layer canopy, so not much got through. And what did get through was supposed to turn the mud muddier. Okay. It also made it red. So one day a pilot is getting briefed on close air support in Laos, which never happened anyway, and he was told not to kill any friendly elephants. And he did what most pilots would do and said, what was that? To a friendly elephant. How do you tell a friendly elephant from a bad elephant? And he was told the bad elephants had red bellies because they would be the ones on the trail getting their belly muddied from the bad, sticky mud. And to me, that story just kind of summed up the big disconnect between the poor guys that were having to do the fighting and everybody else, and just some of the silliness and stupidity that went on. So that, you know, I found myself shaking my head at a lot of that, and I put a lot of that in the book because it's not only humorous, but it illustrates the point perfectly. So there's more of that in there, though. Sir.
I'm here tonight because one of my friends I've known for 10 years flew Huns in 65.
Oh, yeah? He was a weasel?
He was a weasel.
Who was it?
Rich Lloyd.
What? Oh, yeah?
Sorry, yeah. And he was shot down and rescued. And he was a fly. And the interesting thing is that was a time before America really was talking about the war. And yet he's been silent for 45, 50 years.
Yeah.
Tell me about what brings these folks forward now to be able to talk. What is it happening with these men in our culture that you've tapped into?
Well, everybody hear that? I can't speak for them, but we all kind of have the same feeling about it. And you're going to find this with most people that have been in combat. It's not necessarily that you want to forget about it. It's just that there's really nothing to relate to it in normal life. So people ask me all the time, well, what was it like? What was it like over Baghdad, or what's it like to fly an F-16 or an F-22, and how do you compare that? I mean, when we do that with other things in our lives, we always say, well, it's like this, and people can, oh, yeah, okay, I've done that before. But with flying jets or being shot at, there's really no comparison for it. There's no frame of reference. So most people just don't speak about it, because what are you going to say? And a lot of guys, I'm like this too. You don't want to be perceived incorrectly. And usually if you run across somebody that is openly and eagerly telling you a war story, it's probably crap and it's not true, because people that really have real war stories, you may be able to drag it out of them, but they're not going to volunteer it for much the same reasons. I think in the case of your friend, as in the case of the guys in this book, you know, they're all in their 80s now, and I think they want the story to be told. I wrote my first book about my experiences because I was going back and forth to the Middle East as a private military contractor, because you can't say mercenary. And I wanted to get the story down before something happened to me, and my children didn't know anything about what I'd done. And I think with the case with some of these guys, it's the same. You know, they want something to be known of that. And the fact that even though the war didn't turn out well, it had nothing to do with them, which is, again, one of the big reasons for me writing this. Does that kind of answer your question? Sort of. Yes, sir. Hey. You're not wearing your hat this time. Okay. Well, it's fiction. Okay, the novel was called The Mercenary, and it, like most fiction, a lot of it isn't really fiction. And I used places that I'd been to, things that I'd seen, things that I'd done to write the book. Because, you know, when I read fiction, I get turned off if it's too fantastical. You know, I used to love Clive Cussler's stuff, but when he has a guy taking a 1,000-mile inner tube trip under the Andes Mountains, you kind of go, what, what? You know, or James Bond, he can fly all the way across the world and never eat, never sleep, and he still looks great. It doesn't work like that. So when I write fiction, I try to give people kind of a sense, flavor, even smell of wherever this is. And that particular book is about a military officer who gets basically done over badly by the military and goes overseas for a time to disappear, and then decides to come back and get a little payback on the people that screwed him over. So that part's fiction. I didn't actually do that, but I thought about it. But it was a fun novel to write, very cathartic in a lot of ways. It will reprint next year, they say. You can only get it now, unfortunately, in Kindle form. Some people love that. That's fine. I love it on trips, but I can't sit down on the beach with a Kindle and read a story. But it'll be out next year, along with the prequel to that book. It's called The Iron Ring, which is due in 2 months to HarperCollins, so I better get cracking. No, it's done. But so I love to write fiction. I'd love to write more of it. Now that Clancy's gone, maybe I don't have any competition. I don't know. We'll see. And I forgot to answer the rest of your question. You asked me what was next. I'm going to write children's books. Just kidding. I said I was going to write children's books. See, you didn't believe it. Nobody believes that. Well, I am going to try to get around to that, because I think especially for young boys, there aren't enough good books to hold their interest and get them into reading at an early age, and there's very little that's more important later on in life, especially for boys, because boys, you know the statistics. So anyway, I'd like to do that. I'm fighting again with HarperCollins, but there's other publishers, so if I have enough brain bites left to devote to it, I have some ideas. I have the other fiction book to finish, the prequel, and then we're currently disputing the next nonfiction title to do. And if I knew what it was, I'd tell you, but I don't know yet. I gave them three proposals, and we'll see which one they pick. So, sir.
I'm probably doing nothing. I'm actually wondering, from the very first you've had to now, what's your top five memory?
Oh, boy. From the very first time I started flying? You know, okay, I'll give you one. It's not the most exciting story, but it's I'll never forget it. When we were coming back from the second Gulf War, any of y'all ever been to Saudi Arabia? Yuck. What a hole. Well, just get somebody to hold a hairdryer in your face and somebody else throw sand, and you'll get the idea. Oh, and you can't get a cold drink or a tequila or anything else. So anyway, it's a horrible place. Okay, it's one of the few countries on earth where I've got nothing good to say about it. And the first Gulf War I fought out of Turkey, which was not a bad place. And then Yugoslavia was, we were in Italy, and that wasn't bad. But it all caught up to me in 2003 when we ended up at Prince Sultan Air Base near in the middle of nowhere. Anyway, we had a long trip there. We'd finally gotten out. And for anybody that's ever been in a situation like that, you know that when you finally lift off, either on the Freedom Bird or in your own airplane, and you turn around and you look behind it, you just feel this immense feeling of relief. Anyway, I hadn't seen anything green in, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And we landed in the Azores, the islands, you know, off the African coast, basically halfway between there and here. And as soon as we landed, it was a beautiful green island, and it looked like Spanish houses in Ireland. Green fields, rolling hills, and these beautiful white homes with red stucco roofs. And we landed, and we hadn't seen really any females, any humans, anything worth talking about for all those months. And as soon as we shut down and got out, all the permanent party people assigned to the airbase, lodges, came up in several pickup trucks, and they, right there where the airplanes were, off on the grass, they took out grills, and they cooked us hamburgers, hot dogs, milk for me, Mom. I didn't drink anything else. Lemonade. I had some lemonade. And then it started to rain. No, because I hadn't seen rain in 5 months. And to a man, everybody, all the people assigned there scurried for the trucks. And all of us in our desert brown flight suits and nasty boots and beards looked up and laid down in the grass. Yeah, all 18 of us. And you know, it felt like I that's the first time I really believed that I was going to make it home again. I kind of thought the third time, you know, my luck had run out and I was expecting bad things to happen the whole time. And I actually felt I'm going to make it out. And the next day it was almost picture perfect. And those of you who fly know it's never picture perfect, but I mean, nobody broke. We all took off on time. The tankers were all there and we made it all the way back to the United States the next day. And that will always be a very happy memory for me, because that particular war as a wild weasel was very nasty and hard, because they threw everything they had left at us. And the guys in this book were very tough and ballsy, because they didn't really know what they were doing at first, and they didn't have all the equipment we did. They only had one missile to fight, the SA-2. By the time I came along, we had much better self-protection equipment, jammers, chaff, flares, you name it, we had it. But there were also a lot more surface-to-air missiles. There was SA-2s and 3s and 6s and 8s and all the French crap that the French sold to the bad guys, and infrared missiles, and I think the Iraqis had 8,000 to 10,000 guns in addition to all the surface-to-air missiles. And, you know, there were some really, really bad moments. I put some of them in that first book I wrote, Viper Pilot. And I was just very, very happy to make it back. So that will always be a fond memory for me. Sorry, long answer to a short question. Sir, you had a question?
Yeah, you started out talking about how the first wild weasels were F-100s, and they were superseded by L-5s. Can you speak about the transition then to the F-4s, which to me seems not to have been the kind of aircraft originally designed for that mission? It was faster.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, another stunning move. Let's take all the guns out, because we'll never need a dogfight again. Well, you know, in a lot of ways, the transition to the F-4 was similar to the F-16 because the F-16 was never intended to be anything other than a daylight bombing and dogfighting platform, and it has morphed in the 20 years I flew it into what it is today, and it's really an extraordinary airplane. The F-4 had been around in Vietnam since the beginning, and they had decided pretty early on, like 1966, 67, that even the F-105 wasn't going to cut it in the long run because they'd stopped making them. So when you lose one in combat, there's no replacement for it. And they were running out of them, and they never had a whole lot of two-seaters anyway. And they knew that they were going to have to replace it, so they started right away pretty much trying to integrate it into the F-4. But it never really worked right. And there's a lot of technical reasons why, but the end result is that by 1972, when the air war kicked off again after that mysterious 3.5-year lull, I still can't figure out what that was all about. But the F-4, they converted basically one squadron to Wild Weasels, and they brought it. It was in Japan. I think it was in Japan. It's in the book. And they brought it over to fight in Linebacker, the 11 days of Christmas in 1972. In fact, one of the last chapters in here, a friend of mine named Denny Haney, who was an F-4 Weasel, helped me complete that one. And it got better. Okay, the F-4, like most platforms that this gets put into, they had to adapt and change and make it into what it is. And essentially, the roles, you know, and responsibilities remain the same. They still had to have a pilot and an EWO, and they still had to work together. One thing that they did a little bit differently was they took the basic hunter-killer mission that these guys did and expanded it. And hunter-killer mission is when you specifically go out either with other airplanes like you or other airplanes dissimilar from you carrying bombs to hunt the missile site down and to kill it rather than just escorting people into target areas and then reacting. They would specifically go out and they would hunt these things down. And this is what we ended up doing in 1991 and beyond. We had figured out again that suppressing a missile site wasn't going to cut it, and we had to kill it. And we built on their tactics the way that the F-4 guys built on the F-105 drivers that came before. So it's been a logical progression ever since the beginning, which is, again, why it was so interesting for me to get into this. The F-4, again, it was in combat as a Weasel for 11 days in 1972, and then two squadrons deployed to the Gulf in 1991. One of them was the squadron that I was in, and we were true hunter-killers. We flew F-16s with F-4s, and the F-4s would find the missile sites, and then the F-16s would go kill it. The ones down south flying out of Saudi Arabia didn't do that. They carried anti-radiation missiles, and they would just drive in 20 miles or so away from the threat and shoot anti-radiation missiles. It's okay, just two different philosophies of doing business. Answer it, kind of? What else? Your boy has a question. Nice shirt. Is that where you want to go to school?
He's lucky.
I got a ring from there.
I went there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Thought you looked familiar.
What's that?
Just kidding.
What'd you say?
Nothing. I didn't say a thing. Your husband's right there. I wouldn't say that. He's trying to wake everybody up. Well, you know, I was in the Corps at A&M, so I was a cadet. And back in those days, they could use axe handles, cattle prods, and everything else on us. Sorry, Mom, they did. And so it didn't prepare me at all for flying. And I got a degree in architecture, which didn't help at all with flying jets. But all the mental games that you had to go through to survive the attrition process to get into a fighter, they didn't really bother me because I'd been through much worse mentally as a cadet, you know, having my head handed to me every day for 2 years until I became an upperclassman. You were there in 86?
Yeah. I graduated in 87.
Okay. So. Well, then, you know, you yeah. Yeah, okay.
I lived in one of the dorms by the core area.
Oh, good. So you got to hear Reveille every morning. To this day, when I hear that, I still cringe. Anybody in the military like to hear that damn bugle? No? Gosh. we were watching a show the other day, a movie. I forget what it was, but somebody was blowing the bugle at dawn, and my daughter said, "Why are you squeezing my hand?" I hate that sound. So A&M prepared me mentally for a lot of that. And, you know, during the wars when things weren't too bad or too good, to me, they weren't ever that really that bad. You know, I never got so hungry I had to eat toothpaste, you know, like I did when I was a cadet. And nobody was ever going to hit me with an axe handle. So if I'd gotten shot and down and captured, it would have been a different story. But I'd like to think I'd bore up under that. But you never know until you go through it. What else? Yeah.
Who do you think has it harder, the modern fighter pilot or the World War II fighter pilot?
Oh, the modern one. Well, I think that's a tricky question. Did y'all hear all that? He asked who had it tougher, the World War II era fighter pilot or the modern one? And I would say from a threat standpoint, they had it harder because again, they were kind of making all this up as they went. They had it a lot easier, though, because the environment that they were fighting in and serving in was so much different than it was today. I mean, could you see some of the stuff that goes on today being tolerated during World War II? Not a chance. Not a chance. So in that respect, they had it easier in the respect of logistics and basically, you know, the tactical level of fighting. You know, it kind of went the other way. And I envy them that because, again, it was a much simpler problem. But, again, they didn't know a lot, and they were learning it as they went, and the casualties were a lot higher than we have today because we had the benefit of everything they learned the hard way.
So if you could take your knowledge that you have now and go back in time to World War II and fight that, or fight World War III with a modern fighter?
Oh, I'd go back in time. They danced better. They dressed better. They... You know, it was a clear struggle. Yeah, I mean, yeah, come on. The girls all wore their hair long and had skirts, and they had great music. I love big band music. They all drank martinis at 5 o'clock. And again, they were fighting for a cause that nobody argued about, you know. And we saw a little bit of that in this country after 9/11. It's the first time in my lifetime I'd seen the entire country getting along, more or less, you know. And I can only imagine that in the 40s it was like that for 4 years because everybody knew they were all in this together and they had a common enemy.
There was a saying, Colonel said, "Don't you know there's a war on?"
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would have, if I could pick a time, it would have been that. Yeah, I think I'd have fought in Europe, though, not the Pacific. I leave carrier landings to my father, who was an A-4 pilot.
I'm trying to read the story about the B-17 that German pilot didn't shoot down. What tells me with that?
The higher call?
Yeah.
Higher calling?
What a story.
Yeah. And in Lords of the Sky, I made a point to not write it all about American pilots. Because Americans really didn't get into World War I from a flying standpoint until kind of at the end, as an American military unit. And then in World War II... again, we got into it a little bit later, and there were some really interesting pilots, Russians and Germans. A Russian girl, she was she's one of the only two female fighter aces in history. They were both Russians. They called her the White Rose of Stalingrad. When I read that, I figured I got to write about her. And then one of the Germans that's my favorite was Hans Joachim Marseille, and he was a rogue. He was an outstanding pilot, but a very mixed up, defiant human being. He's the kind of guy that when he got awarded the Knight's Cross for the third time, so that's like getting 3 medals of honor, sat down and played jazz music for Hitler because he knew Hitler didn't like it and it had been forbidden. Because what's Hitler going to do to him, right? Guy's a triple war hero, and he's on his way back to North Africa to fight. And then as he's heading back to North Africa, they stopped in Rome so he could get some useless Italian decoration, and he disappeared. And nobody could find him for 3 days, and he was off in the country with one of Mussolini's married nieces or something like that. And again, what can they do to him because of where he is? So they just sent him back to North Africa and let him continue fighting. He's the kind of guy that would never survive in peacetime.
He'd have been a good weasel, wouldn't he?
He'd have been a great weasel because he definitely had a screw loose. Well, what else can I answer? Or have you heard enough of me? Well, thank you again for coming. I always love being back here. And again, I hope you enjoy the book. You can get a hold of me directly via a website, or there's a Facebook page that HarperCollins has out for me. I don't do personal Facebook, but this is an author one. And it's got, you know, video clips from news shows I do and book information. Anybody who wants to get a hold of me, I always answer. It may take me a while, but I always will. And once again, thank you for coming, and I hope you enjoy the book.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.